This is The Guardian.
I'm Grace Dent, and this is Comfort Eating from The Guardian. A podcast where we pay homage to the lesser celebrated foods in life. Because even as a restaurant critic, I believe the food that matters most is often that snack you cobble together when you're curled upon the sofa. Each week, I ask my guest to lift the lid on what comfort foods have seen them through their lives. Because you can tell a lot about a person from what they eat behind closed doors. Hello, friends. I'm standing in my living room, waiting for my guest today. I am looking up at a large, dark hole in the ceiling. It is not at all glamorous. I can actually see the waste pipe of the toilet. What's happened here is that my shower, just above where the guests normally sit, it has been leaking for years, and there has been a very genuine threat that the entire shower unit was suddenly going to plummet and just hit somebody. In fact, all of last autumn, I had a fear it would happen right during an interview with Tom Kerridge. It was never Gregory Porter. It was never John Ronson. For some reason, always Tom. Well, he's come in today and he is in luck because I have taken this bathroom situation by the hands. I am choosing tiles right now for my new project. It is literally all I talk about right now. No, come back. Honestly, I'm not that boring. Here's the problem. I am never going to feel grown up enough to choose tiles. Is that just me? It feels very serious. It feels like a very forever thing. It's like getting a tattoo. It'd be easier to get rid of a tattoo. Every time I sit down and have a wee for the next 10 years, I'm going to look at these tiles. My top tip is don't ask anyone else's opinions on the tiles that you find. Don't show anyone. Just do it. Just go and get them. They'll say that they don't like them. My man saw some lovely ones I found the other day and he said they look like acne. And then I was back to square one. A man who I know could pick tiles with confidence and aplomb is Mr. Tom Kerridge. He has decorated no less than 7 of his own restaurants. He is a multi-award winning chef and broadcaster who cut his teeth cooking at some of the country's finest restaurants. But it was when he started opening his own places that things really, really took off for him. It all began with the opening of the Hand and Flowers. It's the only pub in the world to have 2 Michelin stars. And since then, he's grown his empire to include venues across Marlow and London, including a fish and chip outlet in Harrods. Since 2022, he has been a guest judge on BBC's Great British Menu. He sounds very busy. I'm sort of picturing him spending his days motoring between venues, writing his menus, and brainstorming a mousse bouche. But when the grill's off, and the last guest has finally walked out the door, what is he munching on to restore energy? I'm thinking leftovers.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. 6 factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghigher. Education. This message was paid for by EY.
Tom, Tom Kerridge, welcome to Comfort Eating.
Thank you very much, mate. I feel very comfortable.
Why is that? Is that because you're inside my house?
It is. It's not a house, it's a home.
Yeah.
And it feels very different. So people create spaces and you can feel this as a, it's a home, it has a sense of personality. It feels that somebody lives here and it's welcoming and it's nice and it's lovely. So it already has a nice vibe. So I already feel very comfortable.
I always like to begin with a serious and pertinent question that it's the thing that the nation is asking. Your name, Kerridge, autocorrects to Kedgeri.
I love that. Yeah.
Do you think that led to your involvement with the food world?
Actually, it's because my mum's maiden name was Cook. There we go.
Really?
Yeah, really. My mum's maiden name was Cook. And that was around before autocorrect.
I'm going to ask another important question. Kedgeri. I love Kedgeri. Where do you stand on whether it is a breakfast or a dinner item?
I actually think the reality of it is that it is the sort of thing that you can have. Like at any point of the day, you could have it.
Feels like you're on the fence.
But it does. No. I love the idea of it for breakfast because it's quite a left field choice of breakfast. It's a bit like kippers. Mm-hmm. Like, do you know what I mean? Like if you've got all the things on a breakfast menu and you're choosing Kedgeri or kippers, I mean, you're making a strong statement there. So I would say I think it's a very special breakfast dish.
Tom, every week my guest shares their go-to snack, their bite, their guilty pleasure. It is something that makes them feel just a little bit better. What have you got hidden underneath my, it's a Fortnum and Mason's tea
tub. I was
going to
say, it's very, very posh, that, isn't
posh
it?
Look at that. Because you are a Michelin star chef.
It's very nice.
There's not even any holes in this. I've not even burned it or anything. Can you please reveal your snack?
Look at it. It is the ultimate snack.
Please explain what it is.
It's cheese and grapes, mate. And it is like cheddar and it's red grapes. They're always in my fridge because it's very easy. You haven't got to do any cooking. It gives you bursts of sugar, vitamins, right? Grapes for me, if I've done a couple of days, work them. I don't know. Sometimes if you're traveling, you're just eating rubbish garage snacks. Do you know what I mean? There's no sense of vitamins or health or anything. So if you come in, load of grapes, normally seedless, sweet. So you get sugar rushes, but you also get a sense of vitamins coming through. Mm. And cheese for me is amazing. It's like the ultimate snack. Mm. I don't mind the cathedral city, the pilgrim's choice. Slice of that, some grapes. Anytime, it's just a real pick me up. Energy levels, I love it.
So I'm sensing that you come in on a night when you lie on the sofa with the grapes, just kind of draped like Caesar.
Yeah, I mean that's not actually strictly true. I have a routine of how I do that as well. So I'll come in and I'll take the grapes and I'll work out how many grapes I'm going to eat from the bunch, and I remove them all, right? So and then I put them. Put the amount of grapes so they're like little nugget sweets in a bowl, and then the cheese, and then I'll sit on that, and then it's almost like cheese and chutney, isn't it? That's a thing. But it's a good late night go to snack. Like it didn't used to be that. It used to be cheese on toast, the old tube of Pringles, and a pint of gin. But now it's very different.
Although you've got three Michelin stars under your belt, you've described yourself as not really a Michelin star kind of guy. So I want to understand who the real Tom Kerridge actually is. Maybe it'd be better to go back to the start in a place that I know is really special to you. Take me back to your favourite childhood pub.
There's a number that have been part and parcel of my life. There's a place called the 4 Mile House, which was just outside Gloucester, 4 miles outside of the centre of Gloucester.
What did that look like?
A small little white pub with a beer garden in the back that had like a rusty climbing frame. And it was the kind of place my dad used to take us there when we were little kids, play in the garden, drink Panda Pops, run around, whilst he drink a few pints. But I loved that pub energy.
In this pub, you're going into 4 Mile House. What are they selling behind the bar?
like crisps and stuff? Like what snacks have they got?
The Smith's crisp where you put the salt on yourself. They were the ones for me. Absolutely loved it. Because it felt like you were involved in something. I like that you were doing something. You were creating. You were making your own crisp recipe. And I like, you know, that sense of involvement. I don't know what happened there.
Well, I always think that they're for people who aren't even adventurous enough to commit to salt.
Yeah. Yeah, very good point.
Do you think that's the first time you ever chefed?
Yeah, it probably is, actually. That is the first time that I've added something to create a flavour profile that you would be changing. That is probably a very good point, yeah.
You grew up in Gloucester in the 70s and the 80s with your parents and your little brother, Sam. Talk to me a little bit about family life then in the 70s and 80s.
So it's quite odd. My mum and dad split up when I was... It was actually no different to pretty much anybody else where I grew up. My mum and dad split up when I was 11, but pre that, my dad wasn't around very much. They didn't have necessarily the best of relationships. So
Do you remember them being together at all?
Not really. I remember us being in the same house. There wasn't like lots of family holidays. There wasn't like, we weren't hanging out.
Did your dad work?
Yeah, he was an art lecturer at the local college. And they split up when I was 11. And my dad was also then very ill. So he had MS. So this kind of family relationship, it really was kind of non-existent. My relationship kind of, I remember much more when it was just the three of us.
Did your dad have MS when he lived with you?
He did, yeah, but we didn't really, because we were quite young, you don't really know what it means. Mm. And he moved out. So when I was 11, so my brother would have been 8. Mm. And it was only the next few years after that when you start to realise how ill he was and how ill he became, and that you realise what a hard disease it would have been to deal with, and his world that he was living in and how he dealt with that. And like, it was just all very, and it's hard to put together as an 11-year-old because you can't work it out. I don't think he was the best husband in the first place for husband reasons, let alone being ill. So the reason they split up wasn't anything to do with his illness. It was to do with him not working out together as a couple.
And then your mom is looking after you both. She's cooking for you, creating a home. So you get back from school. What's cooking?
I don't know what they call the kids, latchkey kids. So you would have the key and you'd come back in and you'd open the door and you would cook tea for my brother, because my mum had two jobs. So she'd be working as a secretary and then she'd go and work in a local pub washing up. There'd be a couple of nights of the week that we'd do something. We might make spaghetti bolognese together. But apart from that, it would be normally me doing, I don't know, potato waffles, crispy pancakes, fish finger sandwiches, you know, those sort of things, beans with like little sausages in. That was like the highlight. Do you know what I mean? Like those tinned ravioli.
Did you feel like you were having a hard time, you were hard done by, or was it just...
Absolutely not at all. Not one bit of it. We never felt unloved. I never felt like we were missing out because of the where we grew up. Everybody was the same. We weren't like the odd ones out. It was fairly normal for where we lived. And I think it's probably still fairly normal for most people's lives now. Although every Sunday, my mum would do like a proper roast. She would do like a proper roast dinner. And then we'd turn up with some kids that we'd been playing rugby with on a Sunday morning and we'd all have a bit of lunch. Oh, so it's like, yeah.
That must have been lovely, though.
Do you know what? I think it's the first bit, Grace, where I feel that sense of hospitality where it's about making people feel welcome. It's not necessarily always about the food. It's about the sense of warmth.
It's so important.
So important.
To you, I mean. To people, I mean to you.
Yeah. It's so important. It's such a big thing. Like, there's a point of going, yeah, it's great. We've cooked something. They've enjoyed it. And now they're disappearing off again. But they've had something to eat and they've ridden off on their bikes and not even bothered helping washing up. Like, shaking her fists as we ride off or something. But still, there was that sense of warmth and connection, I think, through Sunday lunch. It is mega. I love it. I think Sunday lunch is so important.
We know you loved rugby, but tell us more about teenage Tom. Tell us about your dossiers, as your mother used to say. Were you a wild kid at all? Come on, I want to know.
No.
I want to know the most trouble you've ever been in with your mother.
No, I can't say that, Grace.
The most trouble?
No, I can't. Tom,
I'm sensing there's a story there.
No, there's none. There's none. I've never in trouble.
Have you been brought home by the police?
I have been brought home by the police.
Oh!
Yeah, I have been brought home by the police.
But what had you done?
In all honesty, I don't remember. Probably
don't
drinking.
Remember.
Probably drinking, probably smoking, probably setting fireworks off, probably putting things through people's letterboxes, probably being like all sorts of ridiculous teenage naughty stuff that people get up to. Like that whole world of chaos that you live in as a teenager on an estate when you're bored and you haven't got a Sega Mega Drive. You know, what else do you do?
Yeah.
But then, because I didn't really know what I was going to do. So I left school at 16. My mum took us to a youth theatre, me and my best mate that lived opposite. I mean, Cheltenham's quite different to Gloucester. And, you know, this posh youth theatre, the Everyman Theatre in Cheltenham, and I come from an estate in Gloucester. And it was kind of like, they also quite like naughty boys.
Always.
Like, and you just go, oh, so this is quite a cool space to be hanging out, like, as a teenager.
It's literally like catnip to posh birds, really.
It was quite good fun. So you just go, well, this is quite a cool place to be hanging out.
I happened to stumble across Tom Kerridge's very own IMDb page. You're listed as playing a bully.
Yeah.
And Thug One was one of your acting credits. What does this reveal about Tom Kerridge as a teenager?
Well, I think it was typecast from an early age. Like, you just go, like, so a Borstal boy in Miss Marple, a bully. Thug One was my official title on London's Burning. That was when it goes up with your name, like the credit, Thug One, Tom Kerridge. I was like, there we go. Yes.
Can I ask you one more question about your childhood? It feels as if when you talk about your mum and your dad, and then your dad was very ill, but did that have a massive effect on you as you, or it feels like you're pretty strong about it?
Yeah. Do you know what? So he died when I was 18. I didn't really grow up with him as a young kid. I don't have massive memories of like holidays together and all that sort of stuff because it just didn't happen. And then from the age of 11 to 18, once he'd moved out, and then he became very ill and then ended up in a home. And then they're like, they're the sort of things that you go through that I think make you stronger. I think at those points, you don't recognize the relevance of how perhaps upsetting it might have been.
Did you see him during this time?
We used to go every week, every Friday evening for an hour or so. And it got to the point where he didn't recognize us or like he couldn't talk or it was. And it, so it was very, very difficult.
Was this around the same time as Cheltenham and the acting or was this?
Yeah, it was about the same time. Yeah. So he died when I was 18. And that was at the point where I was beginning to realize that I need to get my shit together and get a proper job and find my way in life properly because.
Why those two things together? Why, you know,
it was just the timing. So it's an 18-year-old. I needed money. There wasn't acting work. It really wasn't me. It didn't suit me. I was still living at home. I just needed to find a world.
Yeah.
And I literally walked into a hotel kitchen looking for a job washing up. It was that instant moment that it grabbed me.
So you decided against pursuing a career in the Miss Marple franchise.
Yeah.
And instead, at the age of 18, you pursue cooking. And this was a time pre-Jamie Oliver, pre-Nigella, pre-Gordon Ramsay, pre-Bake Off, pre-MasterChef. So who actually is your role model?
The thing that happened was when I was 18, and you look around and all the cookbooks that were around were pretty much almost like textbook style, and you're learning about roux and you're learning about, and it's all quite functional. And then my mum, I think it might be my 18th birthday, bought me White Heat by Marco Pierre White, and it just came out. I just remember sitting on the sofa and opening it, and just the front cover, it just grabs you straight away. And I'd not heard of Marco Pierre White. I wasn't really into knowing or understanding what Michelin stars were or what they represented or what they meant.
Now is White Heat, is it a cookery book or is it an autobiography? What is it? Is it his story?
So White Heat is Marco's cookbook, his first cookbook, that has black and white pictures of the energy of a kitchen taken by a fashion photographer called Bob Carlos Clark. So all of a sudden, this pristine French chef, white tall hat, like kind of polished shoes, the reality of that wasn't like the kitchen I was in. And it wasn't like the majority of kitchens that the British kitchens that we were in. All of a sudden, Marco showed what it was like cooking at Harvey's at that point. Two Michelin stars, this 24-year-old chef, or however old he was, like this creative, scruffy bloke smoking cigarettes, like the energy, the excitement. And it was just like, this is what I'm doing. This is who I relating to. This is who I am. This is so exciting. This is incredible. And I just remember sitting there on the sofa and just being sucked into this book of almost like Narnia proportions, that you're going through a wardrobe into a world that I was kind of already half in.
Yeah.
Working in a country house hotel somewhere just outside Gloucester. And all of a sudden it was like, I am that cool.
So you see those pictures and what do you think? I want that.
Yeah, I want that. I want to be a part of this. I want to live this world. It's great. It's the energy is exciting. It's fantastic.
You're talking about this with more enthusiasm than someone talking about a religious text.
It's equal to me. Like, I haven't got a religion. My religion is this food and this creativity and this spark.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So you're there, you're starting out, loving the rough and the tumble, the creativity of the kitchen. How did you get through those shifts? What's keeping you going?
That's changed as I've changed and got older and recognised that the places have changed and the kitchens have changed.
And were you, back then, were you allowed to drink in the kitchen? Did you drink alcohol?
No, never drinking. No.
After the shift.
It's always post shift. Like no one would ever drink in a kitchen. I've never been in a kitchen where people drink during service. Actually, that's a lie. I've been in a couple.
Is it a case? I mean, look, I've hung around chefs for years and it feels like when you're in the kitchen and service is on, you're high energy. And then bang, the last order goes through. You've done your clean down, but you're full of adrenaline.
Yeah.
And that is when you drink.
Yeah, that's it. It is. It's a release. And it's a release of pressure, excitement. And because of the nature of a lot of people that work in it, there is a lot of conversation about in terms of addictive behavior that happens in hospitality. And that's because these people, us, myself, are made to feel welcome in that world.
Yes.
You might not feel that welcome in a standard stifled office environment. You all finished work, you all had a laugh and mugged each other off, and now you're all going to go and have a beer because, you know, the pub that you know does a lock-in, so you all go and hang out there, or your mate runs a bar around the corner.
I was going to say, I'm like, speak, because we are both ex-drinkers.
Yeah.
And I always say, never drink with chefs. I've done a lot of drinking with chefs. The problem with chefs is that they've always got places to go because you all know people with venues.
Yeah.
So after the lock-in, there's always someone's restaurant. And then after the restaurant, there's somebody's cellar. And it goes on and on.
And it's relentless and it never ends. Somebody's, and it can always end at somebody else's house because there's something else there. And there's someone's
always going to get pregnant.
Or, yeah, exactly. or the police are called.
Right. How many pints could you... We're starting at 11.
Oh, you're in trouble, mate. I would start off with 2 pints of Negroni. Like I would drink pints of Negroni. Like to start, yeah.
You have 2 pints of Negroni.
Start, yeah.
And then what happens?
That's just the start. Then we're on the lagers. You do 6 pints of lager as you finish in at the pub, cleaning down, and then go out. And then it would be, Grace, I really don't know, but it could easily be, on a big night out, it would probably be 20 pints of lager, 2 pints of Negroni, and a pint of gin.
Right. I've got 2 questions.
How am I alive?
Yeah. I'm being honest, I'm not even laughing. How are you not dead?
Yeah.
How are you not dead?
Well, I was very good at it, very big, had to stop. Just went, that's it, I'm done.
Why do you think you were drinking like that?
Because I loved it. And I wish I could do it now without any of the health nightmares that come with it. Oh, I love it. I love the chaos. I love the mayhem late night. I loved everything about it. And I love the release of pressure. I'm slightly disappointed in myself that I can't now ever enjoy a glass of wine or a beer on holiday, because my brain doesn't work like that. It was always, always about getting absolutely smashed as fast as I can and then keep going, like relentless.
Mm. So what, see, I hate talking about rock bottoms because sometimes I think that as drinkers, like I didn't have a rock bottom. I just feel as if like it was like almost like an anchor on a ship that was already on the bottom, and then it just like went along the bottom of the sea for about 20 years. Like there was loads of rock bottoms. But did you have, was there a...
No, mine was an age thing when I gave up. It was because I was approaching 40 and it was a point of reflection. So we'd achieved 2 Michelin stars. I'd done television. I'd had a best-selling cookery book. It was just like all of these things. That wasn't getting pulled away from me because I was battered. That was there and I was drinking. It was all part of this whole thing.
But so, people knew you as that. I mean, the people knew you as really funny, good time Tom that drank. So you had to give away that identity.
Yeah, you do. You worry at first, I think, that people are going to think you're different and that you're going to be, your identity of who you are, suddenly you're going to be forgotten. But like, we're not stupid. As human beings, we're not stupid. You know, if you're drinking that amount, it's not good for you. You know, if you're that size, it's not good for you. You know, if you smoke 30 cigarettes a day, it's not good for you. We all know that. We're not stupid. We know that. So that, like, I was 39 and I just went, what am I doing?
But why? Was there a moment where you went, right, from tomorrow, that's it?
Yeah. No, there was a date that I put in, but I had to work to it. And it was about 4 or 5 months away from that point of going, right, this is where I know I'm going to stop. And I have to stop at that point. And I can't do it before then because there's this happening. And I can't change all that. But when it's that point, that day, that's the end.
You were just so radically different looking, really.
Yeah.
You know, you lost 12.
Yeah, yeah.
You lost 12 stone.
I did. I lost 12 stone. I put some back on. It's in terms of like volume, in terms of weight lifting and muscle mass. I swam. So I ended up with quite a longer, thinner swimmer's body. Stopped swimming, now go to the gym and lift and become much wider. And like,
you're hench now.
I'm using the word hench.
I'm going in there.
But I go through periods of that. And at some point I'll go, right, I'm going to stop that. I'm going to swim again.
As somebody that used to begin the weekend with 2 pints of Negroni and then go on to, you know, drink all the rest, and who likes the chaos and everything, can you please tell me how you managed to meet someone very, very special? Set the scene of how you first met Beth.
So I met Beth. It was my housemate's birthday. So one of my best mates, his brother, moved in with us as well. And he was working, he was a technician for Sir Anthony Caro, who's a major British sculptor. And Beth, he used to talk about this girl that worked there. She was a MIG and TIG welder. She went to the Royal College of Art and she was one of the technicians for Anthony Caro, creating smaller MIG and TIG welded sculptures and bronze casting. Mm-hmm. And then it was his birthday one night and we went out into a club in Camden, into a comedy club, Jonglers. I don't know if you remember it in Camden. So Adam, my mate, was like, come on, it's Tim's birthday, we've got to go out. I was like, oh. And I just remember thinking, I really cannot be bothered to go out. But I had a quick shower, changed.
I was going to say, thank God you had a shower because I've dated chefs.
Yeah,
actually stink of lamb fat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's nothing worse if you've been on the fish all day, you just smell it like it's that. No. It was like shower out and I walked into the bar bit of Jonglers. I walked in and this quite fiery, green-eyed girl just went, give me £3 for the stripper. And I was like, all right? So I gave her £3 for the stripper, and this was Beth, and it was a stripper never turned up. Like anybody, that's the first sentence that somebody says to you. It's like, brilliant, amazing. We got on really, really well. We've been together pretty much from that day.
So it was one of those relationships where she turns around, she says, give us £3 for the stripper.
First sentence, yeah.
And that was it.
Yo, I tell you what, any pretty girl from up north that demands £3 for a stripper, you go, okay, I'm quite interested in how this evening's going to end, where this conversation's going to go, what's happening. And then from there, we've been together since.
Hang on a minute. Right, hang on. Let me wind back. So what I would say is, like, when you date men, they often say that they'll cook for you, and then they can't bloody cook. Yeah. You can hear them in the kitchen opening the jar of Dolmio, you know?
Yes.
So there must be some perks of meeting someone like you in Jonglers that you are going to woo them with delicious food.
Yeah, pretty much. So I stayed at Beth's flat that weekend, and she went to work on the Monday, and I think I was off on the Monday. Maybe the restaurant was shut. I can't really remember. And then I thought, well, I'll cook her tea. And she went into work. She came back and I like boned and rolled a couple of chicken breasts that I got from the 24-hour shop opposite and wrapped them in bacon and done some pasta and did a very simple, but really nice. And Beth came through the door. She fully expected me to have been gone and the telly missing. And actually she'd come back and I'd done a bone and rolled stuffed chicken breast and some pasta and like a cream sauce. Yeah. So I kind of won her over with pasta from a 24-hour shop.
I think that if I come in and you'd done that, that I would have been like, he's never going.
Never going, yeah. It seemed to work quite well. She asked me to marry her after about 6 weeks. She asked me.
Beth isn't just your wife. You opened your first pub together in Marlow in 2005, The Hand and Flowers. Tell me about those early days of your own place.
We were looking for all sorts of different sites and places. We had a house with a studio. But we didn't have enough money. So I earned a salary in Norfolk and Beth wasn't working to try and create art, but couldn't afford any of the material or the, because she's a sculptor, not a painter. Okay, so that didn't work either. So we were looking at what we were going to do. So I said, well, maybe I should get a higher paid job in the centre of London and go back. And Beth was like, look, if you're going to go and do those hours, we may as well just roll the dice and do it for ourselves. So it was like, okay, all right, let's do it for ourselves. And that was the first point of jumping off. And Beth was like, all right, I'll run front of my house. You get to the point where you can cook what you want and we make it work as a business, and I can get to the point where I can make uncompromised art.
Is money better then when you go there? Did you, because you say things were quite tight, and then when you get Hand and Flowers, do you have more money?
No, you don't have more money. Absolutely none at all. But you are in control of a destiny. There's a big fear factor because I'd always spent my whole life working for someone.
Yeah.
So you know how much you earn. So you know how much you can pay in rent, and you know what if you're lucky enough to get a mortgage, and that's it. That's what you can do. Now, all of a sudden, I was throwing that all away. I was 31 years old and going, the only way we're ever going to make this work is by me making it work. So we lived above the Hand of Flowers, and we rolled that dice and took the decision.
What was it like for your relationship?
Well, it's quite hard. First year is really bumpy. Like if you are living above a place that you're working in and you're working 16, 18 hour days, and you're trying to build a business and all the pressures that are on it and the pressures on you as a relationship is really quite extreme. It's quite, anybody who's worked together, I think, with their partner will tell you the same sort of thing, that it does, some ways it really pushes on a relationship and in other ways it makes it so much stronger.
Do you have to go upstairs? If it's hospitality, do you have to kind of be... try and keep a wrap on the fact that you're really pissed off with each other in front of people.
To be honest,
and then go and shut the door upstairs and have a shout.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't think we were ever pissed off with each other. I think we were pissed off with the situation. I think you get pissed off with no escape route. There's nowhere, like, the only way you can go is still upstairs in the business. You know, the only place is like, there's nowhere. It's relentless.
How did you make it work as a couple?
You just make it work, don't you? You just make it work. You just keep going and you just keep driving and you keep going with the, building on everything that you've got. I think if you're a strong enough couple, you get through it anyway, don't you? You just get, and then it starts turning, it starts moving, and then.
But the God, not always. I'd say that hospitality is full of couples that have had to split businesses up and get the lawyers in, and like.
That's very true. That is very true.
And
also.
You survived.
Yeah. Yeah, not just survived, we thrived, like done really well. It makes it everything much stronger and you understand each other much, much more. We've been through so much. You've been through recessions. We've been through drinking issues. We've been through, building businesses. We've been through massively in debt. We've been through businesses having to close. We've been through like all sorts of different things. But I think the joyous thing about the two of us is that we've also been through huge success.
It was only a year after opening that the Hand and Flowers got its first Michelin star, and 6 years later, it got its second. Can you remember hearing the news?
It's quite a weird thing because they sent a camera crew and gave us a letter and videoed it. And as I opened the letter, and the letter says that we achieved 2 Michelin stars and that got, and the kitchen brigade was behind it. And it's one of those amazing, phenomenal moments.
See the emotion in your eyes.
Yeah, no, it is. But it's amazing. It means so much. And it meant so much for the whole team, because everybody had been on this journey, and there's still the people there that are on the journey that were there from that day. And you go, this is so significant. It was just an incredible, magical, brilliant moment for the whole team.
You've now got your own family, your son, AC, who's 8. Now, you didn't have a father figure. How do you think this has impacted the sort of dad that you are?
A lot of it, I think, is down to having a son at a slightly later age. Yeah. Like, you know, my son's 8. Like the idea then when we've got a little baby, the idea of having a hangover when you've got like, it's not. Mm. And now on a day off, I want to hang with him. I want to be a part of him growing up. We talked about earlier missing, like I didn't get a real understanding of a father-son relationship when I was a kid. So I'm learning being a dad at the same time as he's learning being a son. We're going through this journey together and I really like it. And we get it wrong and we get it right. We're very similar. We argue a lot, like the two of us, like because we bash heads because we are very similar. Like my poor wife, Beth, every now and then, we'll have proper arguments but so childish ones, like I'm like 8, go, no, it's your fault. And then she'll absolutely, Beth will lose her shit and go, the two of you. And then she'll walk and I go, see, now look what you've done, mum. You'd be upset, mum. Like, it's just, and then you find yourself going, we're more like brothers, but there's like 42 years difference.
Do you feel like you're learning what fatherhood is because you don't remember?
100%. Yeah, 100%. I've got no point of reference to go, this is what it should be like, and this is what we did with my dad, and this is how it should be. I've got no point of reference. So
does it make you sad?
I think probably more so thinking of it from my dad's point of view, because I think, God, you missed out. Well, you missed out on all of this, partly through your own decisions that you made, also because of your illness. So I feel sad that he missed out on that, but not, I don't feel sad that I missed out on it because it's not something that you recognize as a kid. So it's kind of a weird, you don't know what you're missing in it if you haven't got it. It's only now that I'm going, and I'm quite pleased I haven't got it. I quite like the learning curve. I quite like that we're learning together. You know, I think that's quite special.
You have 7 restaurants now, from the Coach in Marlow to the Butcher's Tap in London, hundreds of covers every day. Not only this, you're doing fish and chips in Harrods, presenting on telly. You do charity work too, around food, cooking, cost of living. You've grown an empire. My question is, have we now hit peak carriage?
Yeah, I think we have. I struggle. I struggle with the idea of more volume. I don't micromanage, but I like to be in business. I like to be in the businesses. I like to understand what's going on.
What's the motivation, though? Is it the money, or is it just the idea that you were this young lad from where you're from, and now there's like this enormous picture of you everywhere time you walk in somewhere. Is that it? You know,
I think it is, because it's not the money, because restaurants, irrespective of what people think or prices that are charged or whatever, they don't make money. They're so difficult. Margins are so, so tight. Now, you mentioned it, we have six sites. We're constantly, still right now, moving money around from accounts to be able to pay bills in different spaces. Some make money, some absolutely lose money. Some go through peaks and troughs. And so every month is a really difficult juggling act. You know, I've just got a bill for a part of a solid top in the oven on one of the properties. It's £6,000 to repair. And you go, well, this month it's not made that. So we've got to move money from there to there to go. And
you honestly thought that you would have no idea how much tops and fridges and things still were in your places. Honestly, if you'd have said to me, does Tom know how much the new fridge is in that restaurant, I would have thought.
100%, I'm all over that. We're dealing with that.
Do you see the complaints?
Yeah, I do see the complaints. Yeah, I see the complaints.
How quickly do you know when I've been in?
When you've been in, mm-hmm. I get a service report every night from each space. So if you've been in and they've spotted you, I will know.
We're coming to the end. But in 2017, you launched Pub in the Park, a festival of food and music. It started in your hometown of Marlow. It is now right across Britain all summer long. But this year, you've got Van Morrison playing. Now, he's a famously grumpy old git. I'll say it. I know you can't. I'm going to set the scene here. Van Morrison has been to Pub in the Park. It's raining. It's a typical British summer. He's got trench foot. One of his speakers has blown and he's properly kicking off. You, Tom, need to give him something to placate him. It's got to be fast. What's it going to be?
Well, just cheese and grapes, mate. That's it. Van Morrison, I'm going to take a look. Forget everything else, Van Morrison. Listen, Van the man. Listen to me. Pilgrim's choice, right? And a couple of red grapes. That'll ease all the pain.
So you're not even going to get a bit of bread with it?
Yeah. And maybe some Irish soda bread.
Tom Kerridge, this has been a roller coaster. Thank you for comfort eating with me.
Thank you so much, mate. Thanks for making me feel comfortable and allowing me to comfort eat cheese and grapes.
Oh, I'm going to have a little bit more.
This episode of Comfort Eating was produced by Tom Glasser. The executive producer is Lucy Greenwell. The music was written by Axel Cacoutier. Visuals by Sophie Harrow. Mixing and sound design by Solomon King. If you love this podcast, then you'll love my book, Comfort Eating. It's a slice of joy, sprinkled with nostalgia about my family, stories of the making of this podcast, and recipes which will leave you, well, frankly, bewildered. Finally, go on, leave us a review, and you can follow or subscribe so that you never miss an episode.
This is The Guardian.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.